hppodcraft.com.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the H.P. Lovecraft Literary Podcast Comments Show for July. This is Chad Pfeiffer.
And this is Chris Lackey, and we're going to be doing comments from the month of June. That will cover The Screwfly Solution, The Phantom Coach, The Old Nurse's Story, Alien bonus content, and the possibility of evil, as well as maybe a few comments on the comment show if we got to get meta, which we do.
We got to do it.
So let's get into The Screwfly Solution.
Oh boy.
This was definitely our most controversial episode to date.
Yeah.
We could probably talk about this all episode, but I think our other stories comments need love as well. So I'm just going to kind of dispatch. I mean, go there and read. There's lots of stuff.
It reminded me that this is, in fact, an internet show. You know, we normally, when we do these shows, people are very kind and thoughtful. Our coverage of The Screwfly Solution, I think, through no fault of our own, because it is about some pretty heavy stuff.
Yeah.
But then also, I guess some people didn't like the way we handled it, and so it wound up getting people riled up. And so if you want to read all those comments and responses and stuff, go check it out, actually, on our Patreon page.
A lot of them were deleted. Some people wrote things and thought, you know what, maybe I went a little too far, and they deleted them. We didn't delete anybody's comments.
No, so I didn't delete anybody's comments.
But the things that disappointed me about a lot of the comments, because I don't mind if people disagree and have different viewpoints. I'd like to hear about it. I'd like to talk about it. But there was some name calling, and there was some very disrespectful comments.
Yeah.
And that is something I'm not down with. People can have different views and should be able to express them, obviously. But I'm of the opinion that you can't tolerate intolerance. And I know that's a bit of a paradox. It's called the paradox of intolerance. But if people are being intolerant, you should not tolerate that.
Yeah.
And also, from a debate and argument standpoint, once you start calling people names, you've lost.
Yeah, it's an ad hominem attack.
If you can criticize ideas, but please refrain from attacking people, especially those you don't know, because people go through all kinds of hardships and have all different life experiences. And by name calling them, you're showing a lack of empathy and knowledge and understanding of that other person.
And also, it's just bad discussion. Look, we purposely keep politics out of the show because there's just so much of that.
Yeah.
This should be a place where you can go and not have to worry about that stuff. But that said, I mean, I learned early on when I was in high school and we'd break out into discussion groups to discuss literature. Sometimes it's going to trip up things that are happening in the world in the reader. And it's okay to talk about that, even if, and I remember, our teachers teaching us how to discuss and be respectful to one another.
Yeah.
I remember one guy in particular who just stood up in one of those first discussions and said, "You're stupid. You're an idiot. You don't know what you're talking about." Mm-hmm. And they had to go, "Okay, see, now this is not the way we do it. You don't have to agree with what the other person said."
No.
But maybe if you sit and you listen, you can see why it might have stirred that up. And,
right. Well, I find if people, I have those feelings and those thoughts, they do come to my mind that I go, this person is stupid. They don't know where they're talking about.
Yeah.
What I'll do is I'll say, where did you get your information? What are you basing this on? Like, I'll try and understand where they're coming from.
Mm-hmm.
Because one, I might be wrong.
Yeah.
Don't know. And two, if you can figure out what they have wrong and why they've got it wrong, maybe you can help them, not be wrong.
Sure.
Of course, some people dig in. And they'll stick to their guns no matter what happens. And that's just life. And you can't change those people. So, move on.
Yeah, exactly. And also, it's not about scoring points. We just want to talk about, you don't have to convince somebody to agree with you.
No, gotcha.
But they should have the space to say this. It was odd because a lot of people were going, I had said in the episode, there's a lot of, women feeling like they're being threatened right now. And people were, oh, God, it's not that bad. This ridiculous to say that this story is literally actually happening.
Yeah.
I don't think I said the story is literally happening.
No.
I didn't think I said anything like that. And I did write a comment to this effect that for me, we all have to have operational definitions. People accuse us of being political. But I think political is specifically advocating for groups, persons, or issues.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't feel like we did that. I just pointed out that this is, I didn't even advocate for gun control. I just said that people are being shot in schools. It's objectively true.
Yeah, it is true.
And this made me think of that because there's sort of a sweeping under the rug of this because nobody knows the solution.
Yeah.
Somebody canceled our show. They said, I don't want to listen to you guys anymore because you attacked my religion and you attacked the U.S. Constitution. And I don't even know what that person's talking about. I really don't.
He can be as sensitive about that as he wants to be. If he doesn't want to subscribe to our show, that's fine.
Yeah, that's fine. That's cool.
We're just trying to talk about ideas and cool stories and things like that.
I felt a little dumb because I thought, God, were we? I don't remember being that political about it. I have to be a little more careful about this stuff, I guess, but...
Well, do you? I mean, I think you're being really careful. I think we're both being very careful about it.
If this show's going to take that turn and you're going to start doing this, then I don't know if I want to listen anymore. And I was like, did we do something different than what we ever do? It's a more modern story, and it was about men killing women, so we talked about that. I don't know, man.
Yeah.
I was at a loss. It was upsetting to me, I have to be honest.
Violence against women is something that has not only gone on recently. And into that argument, you know, let's have that argument. Recently, in the modern world, there is less violence, period.
Absolutely, yeah.
So that's something that's happened. So there is technically less violence against women than there has been, say, 100 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
That said, there's still violence against women. There's still systemic violence that happens towards women, especially in other countries around the world, even within, you know, the Western countries in the UK, America, it happens all the time. It is part of what's going on in our culture, but it is getting better. And people are, I think, movements that make people aware that it's going on and give women the strength to be able to go to the authorities and report crimes. That's all good. I don't see how that's political. I don't, again.
Well, the other thing that reaction was so odd to me when somebody, I can't reference that women might feel threatened in the world without somebody saying, oh, come on, that what's happening in the story is not literally happening. Okay, I don't think I was saying that, but like, we've not gotten that reaction to any other story. Like when we do the Nightwire and I say, well, this reminds me of journalism. Nobody's written in and go, oh, come on, the Nightwire is not literally happening.
Yeah.
So why did that happen on this episode?
I'm not sure. I think it requires deeper minds and a greater understanding of our society to be able to explain that.
We haven't really had reactions like that before. Well, I will say that, no, we're not taking a political turn. I have no interest in convincing people of anything. Mm-hmm. It's just that occasionally you have to reference the world that we live in when you're having discussions about this. Mm-hmm. And I promise we're not going to be political by the way that I just defined it.
Yes, I agree.
But occasionally I might say a thing is happening in the world.
Well, Shoggoth Lord had a comment, and I think we should actually get into one of the comments. I think this is a good one. It says, a piece of art is not born in a vacuum. It is created by a human being with their own experiences, biases, and beliefs informing what they make. It relates to the real world, even if it sometimes does so in tangential or unserious ways. When people cover a story about large-scale violence against women being largely ignored, allowing it to escalate to catastrophic levels, it is also very reasonable to connect it thematically with real-world oppression of women because, and I can't believe I have to type this, the author was a woman and understood how to make this idea so frightening because she had to deal with misogyny and the fear of male violence throughout her life. The supernaturally caused horror in this tale is shaped and informed by real-world horrors. And I think that's important to keep in mind.
Absolutely. Well, I mean, I'm sure when Shirley Jackson wrote The Possibility of Evil, she's pulling from actual characters that she probably met in real life.
Yeah. Well, I remember when Alice Sheldon wrote about how every job that she's ever had, she's had to fight for it because she was a woman and people wouldn't treat her with respect because she was a major in the Army.
Yeah.
Remember that? So she's got a very unique perspective on this. And I think that that's really important to keep in mind.
Well, some folks, to jump away from the arguing that people did. One thing that was interesting is that a lot of folks were surprised that James Tiptree Jr. was her.
Yes.
By listening to our show, I had assumed that was more common knowledge. Forrest Rush writes, a great story and a great episode, guys. The best fiction should leave the reader more than a bit moved, if not perturbed. And judging by how your comments have polarized some, I can only say you are more than doing your jobs. It can't or shouldn't be all fun and games all the time. The stories that we love, weird fiction, can and do say a lot about the world we live in. It should push us to consider our own time and very often serve as a warning. A warning all wrapped up in a not-so-tidy, tentacly bow of horrific delight, perhaps, but a warning nonetheless.
Yeah,
puts a button on maybe talking about this story. But again, if you want to see what we're referencing, go to any of the websites and look at the comments and you'll get a quick taste of the explosion of emotion.
Lots of emotion.
I really enjoy the story and I'm glad we covered it. So apologies if we fell short in some way and made some folks
we're trying our best. We're trying our best. So hopefully, we haven't angered everybody or been too far in the middle or not far enough on one side or too far on the other.
I don't know. I don't know. I'll be a little more careful, I guess, in the future with.
Again, I thought you were being pretty careful.
Oh, but. I thought I was awesome. But, you know. I try to take feedback whether I agree with it or not. Let's move on to the next story, though, the Phantom Coach.
Yeah. lots of talk about the literary device of having somebody pass out or faint when something scary or crazy happens.
Yeah, that's right. We were asking for suggestions on that one.
We've got, here we go. Dan Pratt writes, faint to black.
That's a good one.
That's really good. That might be my favorite. Steve Dempsey wrote H.P. Swooncraft.
Clever.
Brandon Hall suggests Deus Ex Defectus, which God from the Weakness? Is that what that means? Deus Ex? Yeah.
It does sound good.
Shargoth Lord wrote Curtain Keel.
That's pretty good.
I like that one. Kim Arne Larson throws out The Mental Blink and also
Convenientius Bloacustima. Well, it sounds good. I think I'm mispronouncing it, but something along those lines. I think Faint to Black of that list is my favorite.
Faint to Black's pretty good. We got a few more here.
Yeah. Sean Sunzer wrote, so I don't know if there's a literary term for the convenient blackout, but I work as a veterinary technician and we have a variety of names for similar situations. In particular, a vagal response is when a patient has a sudden drop in heart rate due to a variety of causes impacting the vagal nerve, but it often results in fainting. So I propose it being called a vagal point. Mm. Or as is tradition with medicine, you can name it after me because I came up with the idea. This moment is called a Sunzer response. Congratulations.
But vagal point's pretty good. You have to be a little in the know for that one, too. Yeah. I like that. That's makes you feel clever using that one. Forrest Rush writes, sans san, as in upon seeing the unspeakable, unnameable fiend lurching towards him, our overly prepared and normally overly loquacious narrator, also unnameable for reasons never given, went a little sans san.
So yeah, sans without sanity, right?
Yes, without sanity. Yeah.
Yeah, that's pretty good. Make America Great Old Ones Again says syncope or swooner or later. I like that.
The swooner or later moment.
Mm-hmm.
Ben Arbach throws out narrative collapse.
Yes, and Murat Yazin says freeze faint, which is a great Jay Giles Band song. So we were trying to figure out why they were. What were there four ghosts in that thing? And
yeah, in this story, the Phantom Coach was a full coach, and there should have been no room for our protagonist to fit in the coach, because he said there was three ghosts inside, but there were supposed to be four passengers. So we were a little perplexed by that. And Stephen Moore, I think, has an idea.
Yeah, he wrote, to answer Chad's question about the number of passengers, when the coach pulls up, there is guard and driver and one outside passenger. So evidently, one ghost was nice enough to make room for the pushy lawyer inside. Another thing I would like to point out is you mentioned the telescope, but didn't mention its size. In the story, it is described as being halfway to the rafters and having 15-inch optics. That is a huge telescope for that age, and I can only imagine the cost associated with grinding optics that large. What the heck was he doing with it? That's true.
Right. Yeah. In my mind, I was thinking it was 15 inches, like the telescope itself, but it's the optics. The lens is 15 inches.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's crazy huge.
For the end of the story and the question Chris asks, did the master specifically send him out with the expectation that he would indeed stumble upon the possessed coach? I would add to that, not only did he do that, but did the master summon the storm that actually brought him there specifically for that purpose in the first place? During the fireside chat, the master explains that his self-exile is expressly for his commitment in public of support of ghost inspectors. I would not put it past the old man to have been an actual wizard. Between all the books and gear, I would not be surprised if he had the Necronomicon on his shelf as well. The description of his room in the fireside soliloquy the master gives is entirely in support of the supernatural. Hmm. Now, with that said, how about the other way around? Rather than the master summoning him, did our pushy lawyer simply stumble through the moors getting colder until he suffers hypothermia and simply falls down the hill and whacks his head? Was this all just a dream? I don't think it is because of the details in his story, but he technically has no proof. And the last item I'll mention is, who else did he tell? He said he would not tell his wife. The doctor, he just mentions he could not talk about it without falling into arguing. Did he go back and find the master? All good questions.
Yeah, that's a cool idea. That like, he never found that house. He never did any of those things. He never found the guy wandering the moors. He just got knocked on the head and then had this whole dream of this thing happening.
Yeah.
It's very cool. Cool to think about.
That's a good way to analyze the story.
Robert Curtin writes, I wonder if perhaps the fourth perished passenger was in the carriage and our poor protagonist was actually sitting inside of him, giving him that chill. So often accompanying these sorts of stories, as well as the added feeling of uneasiness.
Yeah, I like that theory the best.
Inside of a ghost.
He's sitting inside of a ghost. Just ease on up into that ghost. Ease on up.
Oh, boy. So the next story we're covering is the old nurse's story. Make America Great Old Ones Again says, thank you for the show as usual, my boon companions. Aww. But I do so loathe me a couple of ghosts that go around endangering living children exactly as they would never do when alive. That's a good point.
Yeah.
Sure, the mother went nuts before dying, but it wasn't a murderous sort of nuts, more of a protective nuttiness. The child, on the other hand, didn't seem to go nuts at all. She just died of exposure after being smacked a good one by the old man with a cane. Which sort of brings me to the crux of all this. The bad guy here is undoubtedly the father. His children didn't feel they could talk to him or be honest with him, and it turns out that they were right, because once he discovers the truth, he becomes murderously awful and abusive. Without a doubt, he should have been the dangerous ghost. Instead, he does little but play an organ and reenact some horrible behavior. It is the women who get all the blame and punishment for what happens, despite their relative powerlessness and innocence. And what are we to learn from all of this? Women be crazy.
Yep. That's so true.
Dude, that is some great analysis. And I didn't even think about it that way.
Yeah.
Yeah. Why are those ghost murdering people? They were nice people in life. Why would their death make them evil?
That makes sense. Why is the little girl luring out another child?
Yeah.
It's lame. Ella Sheba writes, this is why music education is important in schools. How else do we expect people to be able to play creepily in the afterlife? A ghost stumbling through some scales just doesn't set the gothic tone. That's pretty funny. If the ghost had been like, start playing the song. Wait a minute. Hold on. Wait a minute.
It just plays heart and soul. That's all he knows. That one tune. So Rafe Ball writes, if my ward and I were stuck in a haunted mansion with a phantom organ player and a ghost child trying to lure my ward to a frosty doom, I would get straight on the phone with Dolomite to come around and cut the mother effing ghosts.
There you go.
Reference to...
Rafe knows what to do in those situations.
Oh, yeah. Well,
Phil Estabrook wrote...
Dolomite knows what to do,
but yeah. Rafe knows to call in the expert.
Exactly, yes.
Phil Estabrook writes, is it just me or does Chris seem a bit tired in this one?
Yeah.
That's a statement. Chris, meh. In the wrap-up, Chris's deep depression, possibly brought on by this fairly generic gothic ghost story, was overwhelming. Well, I don't think you were tired. I think that you just hated the story.
I didn't enjoy the story. Yeah. It was a rough going. And I apologize. I try to keep up my energy and my spirits for the show. I think I might have been beaten down by this ghostly
family. Sometimes you just get annoyed
family.
By the story. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. You know, I'll work on that. Thank you, Phil, for pointing that out. Elizabeth Parcells writes, I'd love to attend a one-man show double feature with Chris Lackey doing the old nurse's story and the judge's house. Pure magic.
Yeah, black magic, because you would watch that show, heart frozen. That's just for starters. I don't think she knows what she's asking for.
Yeah, that's a Pandora's box you do not want open. So getting to our bonus content on the movie Alien, we had so much love for this episode, and obviously we love talking about it because we freaking love that movie.
Yeah, it's a great movie. Shoggoth Lord writes, fun fact, moray eels have secondary mouths just like the xenomorph, which is really cool. It's apparently a thing that animals totally evolved to manipulate and break up food in their mouths while feeding. Also, there's a neat extra detail about the script's indifference to gender that has sadly been lost to time. Lambert and Dallas were originally intended to be trans. Yes, you heard me. In point of fact, in the original cut of Aliens, during the scene where Ripley is being interrogated after she woke up, there were screens with company bios of her coworkers briefly visible in the background that stated Lambert and Dallas were trans. But studio pushback led to Ridley Scott changing the scene, so they were obscured. You could still find slightly blurry screenshots of Lambert's bio, though, which clearly states she was assigned male at birth. Gender just wasn't supposed to be a big deal in the future, even if it's a capitalist nightmare where you're a wage slave to a greedy corporation that pays you in company scrip.
Yeah.
Oh, and it should go without saying, but cover the resurrected in a bonus episode, you cowards. Oh, I'm not afraid to do that. We should cover that movie, man.
We definitely got to
cover it. So you have the reflux, little man.
So you have the reflux. And what are you going to do with that, little man?
There you go.
Oh, we'll cover that one.
We definitely should do that.
We have a lot of love for that movie. So.
Oh, man, I love it. But that's interesting to find out about.
Yeah, it's cool, man. I didn't know it was that forward thinking.
Yeah.
Darren Buxbaum writes, I remember the movie Extro that had face-hugging device in it as well. The movie, definitely a B-movie at best, may have come out after Alien. I'm pretty sure it did. Thanks, guys, for covering this movie and your insight. I just remembered how much it scared the crap out of me as a kid. And there was a lot of talk about Extro, the movie. I think that, or is it Zetro?
I think it's spelled extra. I don't
extra,
know.
Right, yeah.
I've never heard spelled, of it before, actually.
Oh, I remember seeing it at the video store all the time. Mm. It has like a gross monster on the front of it. And I always meant to get it, but it looked really B-movie. But yeah. People seem to love it because there's lots of talk of it.
Yeah, I'm going to have to check out Extra. There's a lot of discussion about it. Alison Albright writes, the movie also works on a number of different levels. It's a horror movie about parasites and body horror. It's a monster movie. And it's also a horror movie about forced penetration and forced reproduction. The adult alien has a femaleish body, but this phallic head with another even more phallic head with teeth inside it. Dan O'Bannon has this quote about it. That's how I'm going to attack the audience. I'm going to attack them sexually. And I'm not going after the women in the audience. I'm going to attack the men.
Ooh.
So it's a movie designed in part to make men afraid of rape and forced birth. I think that's a really novel concept for a horror movie, especially when it's so common to see the rape of female characters used as a plot device or treated with insensitivity by many horror movies.
Mm.
Also, Ripley is such an awesome character. A really well-done, strong female lead at a time when that was less common. I think that's still pretty uncommon.
Yeah.
And there's not a whole song and dance made about it. The movie doesn't explicitly point out what a strong woman she is by having her do any of the usual silly shit. It just shows her as a capable human who was right about the quarantine. It also kills extraterrestrial monsters and saves cats. The fact that the cat lives may be my favorite part of the movie. She does. I mean, she looks for that cat.
She knows. And she goes back for that cat, yeah.
I'm a cat lover. If aliens in the house, sorry, you're on your own.
Yeah.
I'm out of
there. I have to say, yes, you're absolutely right about that. If I was in my right mind, I would leave the cat behind.
Yeah.
However, I think she was probably suffering from a lot of PTSD there, and something about that cat needed to be... She had to save that cat.
Sure. She didn't have PTSD. She had TSD. She was in the middle of it.
Right,
there's
exactly.
Nothing post about it. Yeah, you're right. I might be looking for the cat as well.
Oh, boy. Phil Estabrook writes, topic for a future episode. In Lovecraft's fiction, who is the most powerful wizard we see? Hmm. My first and favorite story was the case of Charles Dexter Ward, which makes me want to put old Joseph Kerwin out there, but really, he managed to kill only around 8 men when they attacked his compound, and then he got gobbled up by a space monster. Even within that story, you could probably point to Hutch as being more potent given his century of additional dabblings. Hmm. Now, remember, that was the wizard that he was riding back and forth, because there was other wizards that were there hanging around. Yeah. So, and then you have old wizard Whately, though I don't know if he was really that powerful, though we aren't given too many examples of his particular abilities. Mm-hmm. There is the witch in Witch in the Witch House, but her abilities seem somewhat restricted to time and space manipulation. There's Wight as well, but he manages little more than body swapping, so we don't have a lot of information about him/her.
Little more, money, I mean, that's pretty impressive, but yeah, I hear you. Go ahead.
Yeah. We don't know what other things they can do. My money is on two figures. First, Randolph Carter, by the time he is the Swami Chandraputra. True. I mean, he is the avatar of Yog-Sothoth. Like, can you get any more powerful than that? That's pretty awesome. He has thousands of years of experience and is obviously powerful beyond normal concept. Second, the thing called up from the salt that went on to kill Orne and Hutch. That guy. Who's that dude?
That's true.
Where Kerwin struggled with the New World, this guy, 1,000 years removed from his time, manages to get to Europe and smash 2 aged wizards, each likely more powerful than Kerwin.
Wow.
Phil, I think this is super cool, but you kind of just did our episode for us.
Yeah, you topic for future episode, it's this episode. I mean, your analysis is pretty spot on. I do think it's Randolph Carter.
Yeah, it's got to be Randolph Carter.
I don't think there's anybody more powerful than...
No. No.
The Swami Randolph.
But yeah, a great insight and a super fun to talk about. Finish up with our last story of the month, Possibility of Evil, Shirley Jackson.
Yeah, Bob Sharp writes, am I the only one who thought of Miss Strangeworth as Southern? As in the Bless Your Heart brand of Southern, where Bless Your Heart actually means kill yourself.
Yeah.
I've lived there long enough to have had too many encounters with types who are sweetness and light on the outside, but filled with worms, beetles, and potato bugs. Loved the reader. Mr. French is just spiffy. You know, that is the sort of stereotype about that backhanded Southern hospitality. I do have to say, I've been living here in the South for just a few weeks, and everybody's been very, very nice.
Yeah.
In fact, I was at a restaurant yesterday, and a guy came in, and he was like, is the food here good? And the woman who was sitting next to me goes, oh, well, let me make you a plate real quick. So she put together a little plate out of the food that she was having with her husband. So that guy could taste everything and know what he wanted to order.
Whoa.
I've never seen that happen before.
That's insane. That's great. That's wonderful.
Yeah.
But that's nuts.
But I have heard the bless your heart thing. I haven't heard it said, but
I've heard it said, and it can totally be like, it's usually when somebody says something kind of stupid.
Yeah.
You go, oh, bless your heart.
Yeah, you know, idiot.
Like, you're trying, you idiot. It's very shady.
It is. But I think there was a bit of that vibe in there for sure.
Juan, just good old Juan, writes, haven't read the story, but as I'm listening to this episode, I'm thinking of another nonfiction book, The Sociopath Next Door. In it, the author explains that in general, sociopaths are not as portrayed in Dexter or Silence of the Lambs, for example. Towards the end, the author writes a fictional character and her interaction with neighbors to illustrate what your average sociopath is like. Mm. The part that stands out, I read this almost 10 years ago, was that the sociopath made sure to kill a groundhog while the neighbors were watching. Just because.
Whoa. I had to check that book out. Although that sounds like something I would read and then it would fill me with fear and suspicion.
Yeah, everybody we'd be talking to is like, are they a sociopath?
Are they a sociopath? Scott McCrate writes, this one, for me, brought to mind Needful Things by Stephen King. I read that book. One of my favorites, The Devil Moves in Castle Rock and opens a store called Needful Things. Each person who browses there finds the one item that would most fulfill their life, but rather than letting them buy it, the devil asks them to do him a favor, some innocuous thing, like the kitty has to throw mud on the clean sheets his neighbor has hung out to dry. She, of course, suspects someone else with whom she's having an issue, and pretty soon the whole town is set against each other, and a near war erupts. Oh yeah, I wonder if he drew inspiration from this for that. That's true.
Yeah.
Max von Sydow plays the devil in the movie adaptation. Great concept that echoes what Miss Jackson was laying down. The little suspicions planted for sick joy of injecting mistrust and chaos into the lives of the otherwise content or complacent, the true meaning of sinister.
Hmm.
Yeah, definitely. Needful Things plays on all these exact same things. And of course, there's a great Rick and Morty episode.
Yeah.
Where the guy tries to set up his Needful Things store and Rick
picks up his own store where it just gives people the good things and none of the drawbacks.
He's like, he's got a great line too. I'm not interested in your Stephen King Friday the 13th, the series store. I know what you're up to.
Comments show. Usually a new goat was what it was called.
Yeah.
Shargolf Lord writes, okay, I was being facetious when I said I didn't want to be a Debbie Downer. But, I mean, come on. Are you going to blame me for using any excuse to say Debbie Downer in a conversation? No, I'm not going to blame you because it is great to say Debbie Downer all the time.
Yeah, and that's a great Saturday Night Live sketch.
Yes. You got to be a real curmudgeon for that phrase not to make you laugh. True.
Bob Sharp writes, not for nothing, but the monster that eats axe handles is a real thing. You and I know them as porcupines.
What?
Apparently, their cravings for salt will drive them to eat anything that gets sweaty. Canoe paddles, saddles, and yes, axe handles. So, you're using the axe handle all day, and your sweat is being absorbed into that wood. The porcupine goes, that sounds tasty, and eats it. Well, thanks, Bob Sharp. I didn't know that.
That is cool.
Now, I'm wondering, and maybe I'm being crazy.
Yeah.
But is Bob Sharp actually a porcupine? I mean, look at the name.
Bob Sharp,
seems to know a lot about porcupines.
Well, we can't prove that he's not.
No, you're right, we can't,
but
I have a strong suspicion.
Well, let's see.
Steve writes, pareidolia, it's why we see faces in clouds. I don't know if I pronounced that right, but it's I guess people trying to find patterns in natural things.
All right. Yes.
Also, Chris, next time you're at my house, check out the faces of Jesus in our bedroom curtains.
Oh, yeah, we'll have to check that out. Steve Dempsey is a close personal friend of mine, and I spend the weekend at his house in December for Dragon Meet, which is a game convention. He lives in London.
Okay.
So Steve is not only my friend, but he also supports our show, which is flipping awesome.
Yeah, that's amazing. I thought this was just some person you didn't know, so that's next time you're at my house is a little familiar.
No. Steve is my friend, and I game with him digitally as well, online. He's a great guy and a wonderful writer. He's written some great stories. He's been published in some of the anthologies we were published in as well.
Good old Steve Dempsey.
Check
that's
him
right.
Out.
I've read some of his stuff. Everybody wrote in some great, insightful comments. Sorry we blabbed maybe a little long at the top about Screwfly Solution, but it was an interesting moment in the 10-year history of this show.
Sure was.
To be stirring up that much... I just don't, it makes me upset. It's like, mommy and daddy are fighting. You know, that just kind of gives me that feeling that everybody was getting so upset because I love you all and I don't want people, I want people to get what they want out of the show. But I like what you said, you know, it's not cool to be mean to each other. So
come on,
let's make sure that doesn't happen again. You're welcome to say anything you want, but no attacks, folks. Please.
Just be nice. Just be nice.
Just be nice, folks. Well, that's all we got for this comments show. Please keep writing in. I hope you... this is the comment show for July, but we were talking about the stories in June. we are already getting loads of great comments on our recent patent show and on the Harlan Ellison stuff, so that's going to be fun to talk about next month. Tune in for that. Thanks again, everybody, for being Patreons, and that's all we have for this week. I'm Chad Pfeiffer.
I'm Chris Lackey, and you've been listening to the H.P. Lovecraft Literary Podcast, only on Patreon.
HPPodcraft.com
has produced this record from actual recordings made at sea.